Attention, please.
Come on over, baby. Whole lot of shaking going on. Yes, I said, come on over, baby. Baby, you can't go wrong. We ain't faking. Whole lot of shaking going on.
This is Attention, Please, in which each Monday at this time we will draw your attention to some of the enriching opportunities, events, and services on offer on this amazing peninsula we call home.
This ground here is, I think, a little harder than the asphalt here. And we have a gold shovel. And we're going to invite Representative Theringer and Cherish to come up and, at least symbolically, break the ground for us. So thanks a lot, Cherish. Couldn't happen without you.
Now, you know, the fancy places usually get a pit with some dirt.
Right.
But we're here part of the real deal here.
This is symbolic.
But on one floor, that's what you do.
Oh, yeah. Look up.
Now we can just throw it out. One, two, three.
Spirits were high last Thursday afternoon as District 24 State Representative Steve Theringer and Olympic Community Action Program Executive Director Cherish Cronmiller together gripped a golden shovel to chip out a small chunk of hard, gravelly soil at the north end of the public health building up by the QFC supermarket, thus symbolically breaking ground for the first new public-supported affordable housing project to come to Port Townsend in many years, before an audience composed of a who's who of local housing activists and politicians seated in the sun on folding chairs set out in the parking lot that is the planned building site for the project. Dubbed Seventh Haven by a special committee led by PT City Council member Amy Howard, the 43-unit apartment complex is the result of years of plotting and planning on the part of OLECAP, starting under the leadership of Cronmiller's predecessor Dale Wilson, who was on hand to witness the fruit of a process that experienced several difficult hard turns before Representative Theringer, who is chair of the Washington Legislature's House Budget Committee, managed this year to procure final funding for the $15 million project. I spoke with Cronmiller when she finished up with her groundbreaking duties.
All right, so I just heard that this is a project that has been years in the making, and you inherited it when you arrived here, and and there was like an instant disappointment. I mean, could you like tell me a little about that?
Yeah, so as soon as I came to the agency, we found out that the agency didn't qualify for the federal tax credits that was going to make, you know, this project fiscally and financially viable. So, you know, it was a decision had to be made at that moment. Do we go forth again? Do we try again for more tax credits? Because every time you apply, every time that you're working on these things, it costs money. Right? Pre-development costs money. And the agency had to invest close to $300,000 in pre-development costs just to get this up and running. So crucial, you know, to make that decision to continue ahead, to apply again. And thank goodness for Commerce and the Housing Trust Fund, because they're the ones that funded this so that we did not have to go through the federal tax credits. That adds some more flexibility to the project. And, you know, we're excited to have their support. And we plan to do them proud with this project.
So tell me, I mean, could you describe the project for me? Like how many units and what? I mean, I heard that there's like going to be services provided and a playground and something for the kids. I mean, what all is included?
Yeah, so it's a 43-unit complex. That includes studios, one bedrooms, two bedrooms, and a few three bedrooms. It also is going to include childcare. So that's going to be from 1 to 5, the age groups, two different classrooms. We are working on potential partnership with YMCA to provide that child care. And so there will be, you know, they'll have a playground on site. This project is also a zero energy project. And that's, I think that's important to note. You know, as we're moving forward, as we're looking at projects, we have to think about how are we being good environmental stewards, right? And so looking at the amount of money that goes in this project, you know, some people balk, but thinking about the long-term operating costs have been considered here. And so subsequently, the solar panels and other options that we're considering for energy efficiency in the facility is going to ensure a zero energy usage. As a matter of fact, standing under the sun, I'm wondering if it's not going to be the case that we may not, you know, give back to the energy grid with any solar panels under this sun. So, you know, it was so thoughtfully done in all of the aspects necessary. The parking being underground, you know, so that we could deal with some of the slope and soil issues, still accommodate those parking needs, electric vehicle hookups in that parking garage, bike rack in that garage, you know, so thoughtful about each of these particular things that goes into overall complex. And I'm just, I'm waiting for a year and a half, 2 years from now when you and I are walking through the building, right? And I can show you all of this stuff. That's going to be really special. And when we watch those families move in, that's going to be really emotional to know that they have a home now. And yeah.
So what is the total cost projected to be? And I know that that's probably a hard figure to get your a handle on, because everything has been just going wildly out of control.
Yeah. Right now we're at about $15.5 million for the project. And, you know, if you haven't done housing development for it, especially affordable housing development that's subsidized and has to meet certain criteria, some folks really don't understand sometimes why a project seems to cost so much, right? But there's all of these components that go into it. You have to think the long-term operating costs. You have to consider maintenance, you know, everything that's going to happen to make that occur. And so a three-story building with underground parking is not a cheap endeavor. And we also want to ensure that it's affordably done, but not cheaply done, because we want to see this building last, you know, for 100 years at least, you know, in the community.
So let's talk a little bit about qualification. Who gets to live here, and how will they be selected?
So the families and individuals that will be selected for here are individuals that are going to meet typically the 50% project and income. And some of them will qualify for, it's a special voucher through the Housing Authority, and it's called a project-based voucher, right? That's different than Section 8, because the project-based vouchers stay with the project, not with the person or family. So it's tied to the actual unit in the facility. And that really helps you, you know, be able to plan out your 20-year plan for operations and ensuring that affordability going forward. We also have special set-asides and agreements with behavioral health is one of our partners. The domestic violence shelter is one of our partners, and developmental disability. So we do have some special set-asides for some of these special populations that struggle to find housing and, you know, need that on-site social support services. So there will be, you know, on-site office, and, you know, we will have, you know, case managers and property staff at the facility to be providing any types of services or support that those residents may need.
And the funding for those services will come from where?
So part of those funding sources all come from, some of it's the 0.01% taxes that we hear about for developmental disabilities, or the county for affordable housing funds. So some of those ongoing operations funds. Some of the other ones are federal state dollars that OLECAP receives to help provide social services support and housing supports in our community. And those will be ongoing are necessary, because having staff providing those services, ensuring that, you know, we're helping those folks ongoing is going to be important, and those dollars help make that happen.
So, all right, so you say that the funding is attached to the units, and how long can people remain in a unit? What determines the duration of their stay?
The only thing that would potentially affect somebody's capacity to stay is if they had a dramatic change in income. So if their income changed to the degree that they were no longer income qualified for the project, right? So it would be a good situation where hopefully, you know, somebody gets a job, they receive some other type of benefit, you know, maybe a retirement comes in as they age. And so they may not, you know, qualify for maybe that size bedroom too. What if, you know, the kids age out, right? They no longer need a 3 or 2 bedroom. You know, can we get that couple down into a 1 bedroom apartment? So you're always, you know, when you own affordable housing, as you know, the agency has other, you know, properties as well, you're always sort of sometimes playing that shifting game of keeping people housed if they qualify, and if they don't, you know, helping them, you know, get on their feet to get somewhere else. So it typically would be that, yeah, they would be over income for the project, or one of our partners decides that somebody else is better suited for the units that they have set aside.
I can see a sort of like possible ironic circumstance arising. I mean, the housing situation being so tight here, where somebody becomes like too prosperous to qualify to be at Seventh Haven and yet cannot find any place to live and thus becomes homeless by virtue of being too wealthy.
You'd be shocked how often that happens and why sometimes people literally are reticent sometimes. We call it the benefit cliff. It's where you start to make just enough that you no longer qualify for the benefit, but not enough that you're compensated for the loss of that benefit. So the benefit cliff is something we deal with all the time, especially actually in the childcare realm is the biggest area. Somebody gets a 50 cent raise, all of a sudden they don't qualify for, you know, childcare support. Well, childcare costs so much money and is hard to find, right? So if you lose that subsidy, that's really tough. In situations where somebody's gonna be stuck there, you know, we're hoping Seventh Haven is just the start of the housing projects that are going to be necessary in the coming years here in the community. And we know that the Housing Task Force, the Joint Oversight Board, everyone is thinking thoughtfully about how do we provide housing at all the various levels, right? So that when we do provide housing at one level, it potentially frees up housing in another way for someone else. It's also with partners like the Housing Solutions Network that is helping us, you know, talk to the community about really needing ADUs and other places that people might have, not as vacations or, you know, short-term rentals, but needing them desperately for housing, especially for workforce, for people who work in our community. And, you know, wages can range in our community, right? Anything from a type of job that, you know, you just receive tips for, you know, to something maybe $15, $20, $25 an hour, that's really putting you in a difficult place to find an affordable place here. And so recognizing the community benefit that comes with all of us playing a part in solving the housing crisis here.
So if this building, by some miracle, were finished tomorrow, how quickly would you fill it?
Oh, well, we did fill it as fast as we could potentially get. Marty, here you go. Sorry, you're going to have to cut that.
Take our picture for us? We got all of them.
I mean, I guess the question really is, how close does this come to fulfilling the current need?
Oh, my goodness.
Much less future need.
Yeah, this doesn't come close to fulfilling all the needs we have here in the community. This is just a portion of that, and we certainly hope that, yeah, it starts to free up other housing or allows, you know, those that are in the workforce in our communities to stay here and stop commuting so long. But we would have it filled essentially immediately. And so as fast as we'd be moving people in, we would be able to do it. I mean, you talk with some of our partners, ourselves included. Our waiting lists are so long that you can't even after a certain while, we just have to cut them off. I mean, once you get to 100 or 200 people on a list, you don't want to give people false hope. And so if you look at our South 7 property, which is senior housing, right, we only have 15 units there. We have a waiting list for that. Northwest Passage, we have a waiting, you know, the Housing Authority. They've got unused housing vouchers, you know, Section 8 vouchers that went unused last year because there weren't enough units, you know, and not enough landlords taking advantage of those vouchers. So the need is going to be great. It's going to take all of the partners. So as you, you know, read and hear about some of the other partners taking on some of the homeless population or some of the population that has substance abuse disorders, all of that is necessary and important, and it's crucial that as partners, we're doing everything we can to support each other and help make the dollars work, because it does take a lot to bring these projects to fruition.
So I guess I'm going to go back to an earlier question, and then I'll let you go, which is, so when it comes open, who's going to get those units first? Is it just like top of the waiting list and on down until, you know, a cutoff?
Yeah, so some of our partners will make the decision with their actual units that we have MOUs and agreements on. So the partners will decide that, and typically it's always by priority points. So there's all these calculations that go into who meets priority points. Are there children? Are they in school? Are they working? What is their income level? Can they sustain, right? That's also another thing. You have to ensure that somebody has sustainability. So you calculate.
So people will have to pay for these units. Right?
Yes. Unless, you know, it's one of the fully subsidized by a partner. No, these are units. These are not for, you know, I was asked the question the other day, oh, won't the people from the Legion just go into your new building? No, those folks won't qualify. Most of them have no income. So they wouldn't qualify because they have no income to sustain and pay for, even though it's, you know, subsidized by the voucher. We have to bring money into the unit to keep the unit operational. It's not a fully subsidized,
Right. And people with Section 8, would they qualify?
No, because, this is a project-based voucher system, so those Section 8 vouchers are different from those. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime.
Speaking with Olympic Community Action Program Executive Director Cherish Cronmiller, this is Steve Evans for Attention Please and KPTZ Community Radio News.
Yeah. Now let's go one time. Hey!